Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on compulsory education when we come back. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of our two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. And rule number one is, don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut, and then shut up. If you can learn rule one, you can win about 90% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Now, your government is fully capable of making their case without any help from you whatsoever. So don't give the prosecution the victory. At least make him work for it. Listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation, and indeed, in some cases, police intimidation. The first judge said this. He said, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? And he said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, in Belknap versus United States, another judge put it this way. He said, you can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. The third judge put it like this. In Marchetti versus United States, he said, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and then it's free of charge. That's the best part. That's the place to start. Doesn't cost you anything. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, and click on to the archives page, and then you'll find our free general law CD package there, and you can download it yourself. All right, we're talking about compulsory education. Your government requires that you send your children to public school. And last time we took a look at the quality and the competence of the teachers. It is a tragedy. And I don't think it's that bad in Japan or in other countries around the world. But you can rest assured that the standards are eroding. If your government is in control of your education system, you can rest assured that it's eroding. Here in the United States, we used to have a pretty good system. In 1895, there was a test given to eighth graders in Kansas. And this test given to eighth graders back in 1895 was so strenuous, it was so all-encompassing, that today, when we show this test to students here at the law school and we say, hey, could you pass this test? Nobody can. Nobody today can pass this test. I have the best score that I've seen so far is 78%. Let me give you a couple of three questions here. It's all contained on one page. Here's the whole test. It's on one page. And it's a six-part test. This is the eighth grade final exam from 1895 from Salina, Kansas. It was taken from the original document on file at the Smoky Valley Genealogical Society and Library in Salina and reprinted by the Salina Journal. Eighth grade final exam, Salina, Kansas, 1895. Now listen to this. Here's the geography test. 10 questions. Just 10 questions. And if you can answer these 10, you're going to be a genius. Listen to this. Question one, what is climate? Upon what does climate depend? Two-part question. Question one, what is climate? Do you know? And upon what does climate depend? Question two, how do you account for the extremes of climate in Kansas? Question three, of what use are rivers? And of what use is the ocean? Question four, describe the mountains of North America. Question five, name and describe the following: Monrovia, Odessa, Denver, Manitoba, Hecla, Yukon, St. Helena, Juan Fernandez, Aspinwall, and Orinoco. Question six, name and locate the principal trade centers of the United States. Seven, name all of the republics of Europe and give the capital of each. Eight, Why is the Atlantic coast colder than the Pacific coast in the same latitude? 9. Describe the process by which the water of the ocean returns to the sources of rivers. 10. Describe the movements of the earth and give the inclination of the earth. 10 questions. That's a geography session. There is an orthography section. There is an arithmetic section, U.S. history, and grammar. So you had to answer 7 questions on grammar, 10 questions on arithmetic, and 8 questions on history, and 10 questions on orthography, and 10 questions on geography. That's in the 8th grade. 8th grade. 78% is the best we've seen so far in answering these questions. Now, to say that education in America from 1895 has degenerated to the present time is an understatement. It's an understatement. Now, let me show you a little something here about cheating that's going on in American schools. Cheating. Let's talk about cheating here. What's going on here? This is from the Reader's Digest by Tucker Carlson. That's outrageous. Reading, cheating, and arithmetic. It's a 10th grader's dream. Your teacher catches you cheating, and your parents take your side. That's exactly what happened last December to a group of sophomores at Piper High School in Piper, Kansas. Teacher Christine Pelton had assigned her students a semester-long biology project. When the children turned in their papers, Pelton found that almost a quarter of them, 28 out of 118, had been plagiarized. And not only had they been plagiarized, but plagiarized very poorly. And according to Pelton, entire sections of the papers were identical. They were copied from the same internet websites. She had already warned her students about cheating and its consequences, and each of the 28 offenders received a 0 on the assignment and a failing grade in the class, but only temporarily. Soon, parents of the 28 complained to the local school board, refusing to believe that their child had cheated. The penalty, all of the parents said, was too harsh, and the school board agreed. Pelton was instructed to give the cheaters partial credit for their work. The cheaters were thrilled. The next day, Pelton told the Kansas City Star, "I went to my class and tried to teach the kids, but they were whooping and hollering and saying, 'We don't have to listen to you anymore.'" Her authority gone, Pelton did the only thing she could. She immediately quit in protest. Now, most teachers don't quit. At many high schools and universities, cheating is routine. Teacher apathy is normal. And a series of studies by Rutgers University professor Donald McCabe found that on most campuses, more than 75% of students cheat. Did you get that? Here's Professor Donald McCabe, and he found that on most campuses, more than 75% of the students cheat. And why wouldn't they? According to McCabe, a 1999 survey of 1,000 faculty members at 21 colleges found that one-third of those who were aware of student cheating in their course in the last 2 years did nothing to address it. Let me get that number again. One-third of the college professors in college found that their students were cheating to some degree and did nothing about it. Next. In other words, there are far more plagiarists on campus than there are Christine Peltons. The internet has made plagiarism particularly tempting. Dozens of websites with names like schoolsucks.com offer pre-written term papers for sale at bargain prices. Need 5,000 words on feminist consciousness and gender roles in pre-Columbian Latin America? It's only a mouse click away. And on the other hand, so is discovery. Technology has made catching cheaters just as easy. Several websites offer software that automatically compares the text of a student's work against a database of thousands of term papers and published books and articles. If there's a match, there's likely plagiarism. Last year, a physics professor at the University of Virginia ran 1,850 of his students' papers through a service called Turnitin.com. He came up with 122 cases of plagiarism. Christine Pelton used the same service to catch the 28 plagiarists in her class. And over the past few years, dozens of colleges have begun using similar software, but some haven't. Now why? Well, because policing plagiarism might hurt a cheater's self-esteem. When Columbia considered buying anti-plagiarism software, some opposed the idea. Catching cheaters shouldn't be a hang-them-out-to-dry process, but rather an educational one, said Kathleen McDermott, the Associate Dean of Academic Affairs, in an interview with the Columbia Daily Spectator. Her colleague, Cassandra Johnson, the Associate Dean of Student Affairs, agreed. Columbia should deal with cheaters in a more sensitive, enlightened way, Johnson explained. When students plagiarize, that usually means there's something else wrong in their lives that needs dealing with. What sinister force is driving America's college students to cheat? Well, you guessed it. Professors. When professors fight plagiarism, warned Rebecca Moore Howard, in an op-ed she wrote last year for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We risk becoming the enemies rather than the mentors of our students. We are replacing the student-teacher relationship with the criminal-police relationship. Worst of all, we risk not recognizing that our own pedagogy needs reform, big reform. As the director of the writing program at Syracuse University, Howard Wood, you'd think, abhor plagiarism above all academic sins. Sure, she feels obliged to say it is wrong to download somebody else's work in total, but in the end, she sounds more like a skillful apologist. In her telling, students plagiarize not because they're dishonest and lazy, but because they're tired. Many of them are working long hours at outside jobs and henpecked by perfectionist teachers. We deprive them, Howard writes, of a respectful audience if we tear apart the style, grammar, and mechanics of their papers, marking every error without discussing with them why it matters. Plagiarists as victims, teachers as oppressors. It's not your conventional take on cheating. Not surprisingly, it has been a hit with many college students, just as it was with the plagiarists at Piper High. The student newspaper at Stanford ran an editorial attacking the use of anti-plagiarism software as a potential violation of the school's honor code, which prohibits professors from taking unusual and unreasonable precautions in their academic procedures. Moreover, the paper said, checking for cheating might even harm the relationship between students and faculty. Darcy Jones, a human performance major at San Jose State, summed up her opposition to anti-plagiarism programs this way. The software is probably here for the right purpose, she told the student daily, but it totally hurts a person's right to choose whether or not they want to plagiarize. A person's right to choose plagiarism, laugh if you want, but cheating just may be the next civil right. Well, okay. Remember now that these professors are products of the public educational system. And the public education system has thrown God, the Bible, and school prayer out. And with it, they threw out morality. They threw out ethics. And so now, what we have is cheating, and then we have a lack of morality, and we have a lack of ethics. And the people who are running Bank of America, you know, and Citicorp and Goldman Sachs, the people that are taking the bailout money and then passing it out to their crony friends at your expense, they're all educated in public school. They all have the same morals. That is, they don't have any. They all believe in evolution, and they're all out there to rape, rob, and pillage, and they think it's their right. And that's because they don't have any standards. And that comes from the teachers. Now, somebody's going to write me a letter, and they're going to say, yeah, but wait a minute, this was a good teacher. Yeah, and she's a teacher that quit in protest. Yeah, how many good teachers are there? How many good, competent teachers are there in public school? Well, there shouldn't be any, because like this teacher here, she quit. Which is exactly right. And she should go take a job at the local Catholic high school and start teaching the students over there that have some morals. She should go to work for some outfit that teaches morality, that's got some standards. And then that would leave all of the bad teachers in public school where they belong. The teachers that are good in public school, they wouldn't be in public school if they were good. They would have quit just like that one did. You know, that's where reality is. Somebody ought to blow the whistle. There ought to be more whistleblowers. And there aren't. There aren't whistleblowers in Congress. There aren't whistleblowers in government, because if you blow the whistle, you can't get along because you can't go along. If you want to get along, you have to go along. And what we need here is somebody to stand up like this teacher here and quit. I don't know where she went to work. I presume she went to work someplace where cheating isn't the norm. But hey, listen, cheating in public school shouldn't be a surprise. Remember in the last program I showed you, 900 out of 3,300 cheated. What was that percentage again? These are the teachers now. Let's take 900 and divide that by 33, 27%. So 27% of the teachers were caught cheating in their own tests. Well, teachers that cheat are sure as hell not going to be very, very prone to knocking cheating of their students now, are they? They're going to be tolerant of it because they themselves are cheats. All right, now that's the dilemma that we find ourselves in. Now, the public school system over here turns out ignorant students because the students are being taught by ignorant teachers, and the students are cheaters because the teachers are cheaters. Now, I mentioned the other day we were talking about the problems with public school, you know, such as burglary and arson, rape, robbery, murder, suicide, absenteeism. You know, you would not, I would think, you would not send your child to a summer camp where it was possible or probable that your child would be murdered, burgled, burned, or be the victim of vandalism, extortion, drug abuse, or alcohol abuse, or gang warfare. I would presume that if you were going to send your kid to summer camp, and I used to send my daughter to summer camp, and before we would send them, we would want recommendations and what were other people's experiences there? And we kind of looked at it kind of hot and heavy. What kind of teachers do you have there? What kind of what kind of satisfaction from the other parents that sent their children there? We don't do that with public school. We presume that public school is a good place to send our kids because it's compulsory. The government requires it. This same government, by the way, that requires that you send your kid to public school. Now, they require that they hire sodomites and lesbians to teach there. And that's a civil right. So just bear in mind, did you want your child taught sex education by a sodomite? Now, maybe you do. And if you do, public school is the place to send them. But if you don't, who in his right mind would want to send his kid to public school to be taught sex education by a sodomite? I mean, let's wake up and smell the coffee. You want to teach your child morality, why would you send your child to public school? Would you send your kid over to the Bloods or the Crips to learn morality? I mean, those are gangs that kill people and deal drugs and practice rape, rob, and pillage. Now, if you want your kid to learn rape, rob, pillage, drugs, murder, I can't think of a better place than the Bloods and the Crips. I mean, after all, that's their business. That's what they do. You know, it's your choice. Now, if I had a choice, I'd want my kid, you know, to be protected from that. I wouldn't want to send him into harm's way. Let's take a look at some of the academic achievements of our students over here. First of all, I mentioned to you a couple of days ago, we were talking about this thing. I said, here's what I've got against public school. And I gave you a list. There was 60-some items there. And I said, this is what's wrong with public school. Now, one of the things that's wrong with public school is that they employ incompetent teachers. And because they employ incompetent teachers, and when I send my child to the public school, I don't know which teachers are going to be competent and which are going to be incompetent. If I could send my kid to public school and I was sure that all of the teachers were competent, you know, then we would have a different dialogue here, wouldn't we? Now, from a perspective of a general contractor, when I call the union hall and I say, send me out a plumber, carpenter, or an electrician, when the guy gets out there, we know that this guy is competent. And it's because there are standards that we follow in the construction industry. If he's a non-union plumber, carpenter, electrician, we don't have a clue, do we? I mean, we don't know. But if this is a union guy and he comes out here on the job, he's been through 4 years of apprentice training. Now, it is true, there are union guys that come out and they're better carpenters than other guys. But I'm telling you that there's a basic standard for every single one of them. And we all know what that basic standard is. Every union carpenter can cut a board 67¾ plus or minus an eighth. There isn't a one that can't. Never saw one. Now, if there is one out there, I've run across him. Now, I've run across some guys that called themselves carpenters and came out here and couldn't cut a board straight. They couldn't cut that thing plus or minus a quarter of an inch. I've seen that happen. Now, but my point is that we've got some standards that we go by. The public schools don't have any standards. That's the point. You don't know. And then they're out here teaching others. Now listen to this. In public school, 50% of the students could not say even approximately when the Constitution was written. Now, you go into a public school, just any public school in America, and you ask 50% of the students. See, just take half the students. Half of them cannot tell you when the Constitution was written approximately. You know, like, oh, it was back in the late 1700s. It was around 1800. That would be approximate. Yeah, the Constitution of the United States was written about 1800. If you didn't know that it was in 1787, well, okay, maybe you didn't know that it was 1787, but it was sometime around the end of the Revolutionary War. So if you said, well, around 1780 to 1790, that'd be approximate. Half the students could not do that. Now, that's Americans. Now, you French people over there, I can understand a Frenchman not knowing when the American Constitution was written. But shouldn't you Frenchmen know approximately when your Constitution was written? And you Englishmen over there, shouldn't you know approximately? You know? All right, so let's try another one here. In public school, 33% of the students do not know that the Declaration of Independence signaled the American colonists' break with England. One-third, that's one student out of every three, doesn't know that the Declaration of Independence was the break with England. Don't you think that that's pretty significant? Well, I want to tell you that when I was a kid in school, now I'm an old man, 70 now, but I got to tell you, when I was a kid in school, if you didn't know the Declaration of Independence by fourth grade was the break, you couldn't get into the fifth grade. I'm telling you. There was a question on this 1895 test that I showed you a little earlier here about Europe and its capitals. Well, I didn't know that until I was in eighth grade. You had to be able to name all the capitals and all the countries of Europe And at that time, I think there was, if I remember right, 27? 27, if I remember right. We had to do Africa, and as I recall, at that time, there was about 58 countries in Africa. There's more now, but, you know, when I was a kid going to school, we still had Madagascar and Ceylon, you know. Today, I don't know, Madagascar is called something else, and Ceylon is something else. I forgot the names of them now. But now, when you're going to school, and you're learning from the teacher, and the teacher cannot teach you what you don't know. Now, obviously, for some reason here, 50% of the students couldn't say even approximately when the Constitution was written, and 33% did not know that the Declaration of Independence signaled the American colonists' break with England. In public school, 50% of the students failed to recognize Patrick Henry as the man who said, "Give me liberty or give me death." Well, what happened that we forgot about Patrick Henry and George Washington and Ben Franklin and some of the sayings that they came up with? You know, famous words, you know, like a penny saved is a penny earned. And, whatever happened to that? In public school, 20% of the students could not identify George Washington as commander of the colonial forces during the Revolution. Couldn't identify our first president as being the general that led the American forces. In public school, when asked to identify the two largest states in the Union, 50% could not. In public school, 80% of the students cannot name the two smallest states in the Union. In public school, 50% of the students could not place World War I between 1900 and 1950. Half of the people in public school, the students in public school, cannot put World War I between 1900 and 1950. In public school, 67% of students do not know when the Civil War took place. In public school, 75% of the students are unable to say within 20 years when Abraham Lincoln was president. Can you believe this? Now, you know, you may be a student. You may be sitting there saying, "Well, who cares?" I care. I care. See, they keep telling me that you young people out there are the future of America. Son, this country doesn't have any future with fools like this. There just isn't any future here. Now, America is in its death throes. This is an empire, a civilization, just like the old Roman Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Assyrian Empire, and it's in its death throes. That's why I care. So when I hear somebody say, "Well, who cares?" That's some fool that doesn't have any understanding. He does not understand the consequences that come from this kind of foolishness. There are consequences that come from this. So the point that I'm making is that, hey, if you want to survive this, you're going to have something between your ears, you know, beside a video game or television or you know, who can dance. I mean, that's all nice entertainment, but when we get down here on the bottom line, at some point in time here, we're going to have to come to grips with reality. Now, the people who are in control of our government, you know, people like Tim Gaither, who runs the Treasury Department, and President Obama, who's running the White House now, these people are the products of the public school system. They have the morals of alley cats. They are thieves and liars, and they're lying to us and they're stealing from us. That's why I care. Taking morality out of the public school system, throwing the Bible out, throwing out morality, is a mistake. It has a consequence, and it's going to come back and bite us in the ass. That's the bottom line. There's a consequence that comes from this kind of foolishness, and this kind of foolishness needs to be faced, confronted, and defeated. And we're not going to do it with public school. There is a solution to the problem, and I'm going to tell you about it when we come back. Meanwhile, back here on the farm, you are listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear in this program are mine, or mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about compulsory education. Now, governments around the world require that the young people of their countries be educated. Now, you would think that here in America we would want to educate our young people to the standards of our history and to the standards or the historical importance of our Constitution, Bill of Rights, Declaration of Independence, historical figures like Abraham Lincoln, historical events like the Civil War. Now, we're obviously not doing that, or we wouldn't have seen the numbers that I just shared with you, that 50% of the students don't know this, and 40% of the students don't know that, and 20% don't know something else. That's ignorance, pure and simple ignorance. Now, a student cannot learn about Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War from a teacher that doesn't know about Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. You cannot teach somebody something that you yourself don't know. Now, what we do here then is going to be important for the outcome for your children and for the future. Now, there's things that I don't know that I want my children to know, and so I send them to a teacher who can teach them what they don't know, what I don't know. So if we were to look at this pragmatically and say, well, I'm not competent and qualified to teach electricians, but I do know of a source. I do know where I can send this guy to give him that kind of education. Now, that's the solution to the problem, and this is called homeschooling. Homeschooling. Now, there's another way to do this. You can send them to parochial school. Now, remember, the parochial schools turn out children who score at the 80th percentile. It's a little poorer on average than is the homeschooling program, but it's far superior to the public school program, and I'm not knocking parochial schools. The problem that most people throw at me is that I cannot afford to pay my property taxes and then not send my kid to public school because I'm throwing my money away. Or they'll say, well, it would cost me double. I would have to pay my property taxes and pay for the public school and then send my kid to the local parochial school, and I got to pay full bore tuition for that. Now, the tuition on average is about $2,500 a year for parochial school per student. You know, if you got five kids and it's $2,500 each, I concede that's quite a chunk. And that's the biggest argument that people have. You know, if I was rich, I could afford it. All right, so for you people out there that can afford it, you know, you're a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, you're a professional, instead of sending your child to public school to have him dumbed down, why don't you take some of that money that you're making and forego the yacht, forego the airplane, and take the money and educate your kid to the standards that you believe that he ought to be educated to. For instance, let's say you're a Mormon and you're living out in Salt Lake City, and you're a businessman and you're making a couple hundred grand a year. Why don't you take $2,500 and send your kid to the local Mormon parochial school, so that your kid's got a good shot at an intelligent education, you know, for the future. Now, there might be some hope for some of us, not for the nation, though. The nation's dead. But there might be some hope for some individuals that can come out of the nation. I mean, there were survivors from the Roman Empire. There were survivors from the Babylonian Empire, you know. The British Empire collapsed here in our lifetime. Hell, there's still survivors from Great Britain to this day. Now, there's an outfit called the Heartland Institute, and they're kind of hot and heavy into education. They have a number of interests. It's a think tank type of operation. It's a group of people, an institution that's set up to lobby Congress to enact legislation and change laws, and to what they believe is to their standards. Now, there's a fellow here named David W. Kirkpatrick, and this is from the Heartland Institute, dated 7/28/07. This guy Kirkpatrick writes some pretty good articles. I've read these before. I've reported on them before. Listen to this article here. Homeschooling benefits are real and widespread. So here's an article from the Heartland Institute. They're located at 19 South LaSalle Street, number 903 in Chicago. and the zip code is 60603. And their telephone up there. You got to write this down because you might want to subscribe here. It's called the Heartland Institute. Their phone number is 312-377-4000. Again, that's 312-377-4000. Their webpage is www.heartland.org. Just heartland.org. Well, the evidence, he says, that homeschooled students do well is more than special interest pleading. Departments of Education in such states as Alaska, Tennessee, and Washington have conducted studies that found the typical homeschooled student comes out ahead on virtually every significant measurement. Okay? Virtually every significant measurement, the homeschooled child comes out ahead. Specific instances abound. And one family sent three homeschooled youngsters to Harvard. A homeschooler wrote a bestseller at age 15. Homeschoolers placed first, second, and third in the 2000 National Spelling Bee. Patrick Henry College in Virginia was founded for such students. And former U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Bill Bennett, has suggested, probably only partly tongue-in-cheek, that maybe we should subcontract all of public education to homeschoolers. Self-esteem is a goal for students much proclaimed by many public educators, a goal that, whatever its merits as a theory, has created much controversy. John Wesley Taylor found in research published in 1986 that homeschooled children did far better when measured for this attribute as well. Only 10% were below the national average. By definition, among the general student body, 50% score below average. Okay, now that's pretty important. So let's take a minute here and let me give you some numbers here. Remember, the average homeschooled student scores at the 86th percentile. The national average is 50% in public school. Only 10% of homeschooled children score below that 50% or 50 percentile. Now, let's be realistic. You got 3 million children that are being homeschooled. There are going to be some incompetent homeschooling parents. And that's the way life is. You know, if you had a perfect public school, there's going to be one or two incompetent teachers. And that's just the nature of the beast. What my complaint is that we've got incompetence at the 25, 35, and 50% level in our public schools. I mean, that's stupid on its face. Yes, it's true. You may have out on a construction site one or two incompetent carpenters. But boys and girls, it isn't 25%. It isn't 50%. You're going to have a dummy. And then when you catch the dummy, you fire him. That's all. We don't tolerate that in a real world work circumstance. So there are going to be a few incompetent homeschoolers, but it only affects 10% of the students. Get this, of the tested students that are homeschooled, the average is 86. It's the highest in the country. It is the best program. Only 10% of them score below 50. Only 10%. I doubt if any of them score below 28, which is the standard in the inner city public schools. I mean, think of that. So when you're sitting there saying, well, I don't know if I could homeschool my kids, let me point out, that of the homeschooled students, only 10% failed the 50% mark, which is the national average, for crying out loud. They only score 50. Now remember, I said when I was a kid in school, 70 was D-. You had to get 70 to pass, for crying out loud. Now, if you were going to be anybody that was going to, you know, amount to anything, you had to at least have C's. That required that you scored up around 80 to 85. Now, if you could score from 85 to about 92, as I recall, that was a B. And then if you could score above 92, you got an A. Now, if you can score 86, boys and girls, that's a solid B in anybody's language. 50 is flunking. America's schools are a total failure. If you take the whole public school system, it is a total failure compared to 50 years ago. Just absolutely. Just an absolute failure. Now, surely we can do something better than that. And the answer is homeschool. And that's because you can afford homeschool as poor as you are. Even with the taxes you're paying, it costs, on average, $546 to educate a child for 1 year in a homeschool. $546. Hell, if you've got a kid, you know, that's, you know, 12 years old, he can deliver newspapers, for crying out loud, and pay for his education. So any kid 12 years old can be homeschooled. You can deliver newspapers. You can go out and do something, mow grass, do something. Now, more than 200 colleges, including prestigious institutions like Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, actively seek to attract homeschooled students, not only because of their high SAT scores, but for their advanced social skills as well. So much for the rhetorical concern about socialization. That's another complaint that I hear a lot about. Why, if I didn't send my kid to public school, why, he wouldn't be socially acceptable. Oh, no, you get that wrong. When you send your kid to public school, he takes drugs because that's socially acceptable in the public schools. He dresses like a slob because that's the way the rest of the kids are dressing, and so he wants to dress like a slob. Homeschooled children are better socially adaptable to the real world because they're dealing with adults on a daily basis. They are not being influenced by peer pressure by other dumb students. They're being influenced by peer pressure from aunts and uncles and mothers and fathers and other adults in an adult environment, which is where your child is ultimately going to end up, in an adult environment. Now, a 1960 study for the Smithsonian Institution by Harold McCurdy concluded that genius is more likely to develop among children who spend more time with their parents and other adults and spend less time with their peers and have freedom to work out their own fantasies. McCurdy also suggested the public school system tends to do the reverse and restrict the development of geniuses. So when we take a look at the number of people who are geniuses in society, and we compare those with the number of people that come out of public school and out of homeschool, we find that there's a higher percentage that come from a homeschool environment. So the homeschool environment encourages geniuses. It encourages adult behavior. Martin Engel, head of the National Demonstration Center for Early Childhood Education in Washington, D.C., many years ago, said children sense rejection if they're schooled too early. Raymond S. Moore, citing Engel in a September 1985 article, suggested early schooling may be the most pervasive form of child abuse in the 1980s. That may be carrying things a bit too far, but in the face of the evidence, there is no justification for the hostility so many public school supporters seem to feel toward homeschoolers. In district after district, they are rejected when they try to participate in a limited number of school activities, academic or extracurricular, although a number of states now require public schools to allow such participation. In Pennsylvania, which lacks such a law, hundreds of school districts do this voluntarily. As Stephen Ahrens wondered in his 1983 book, Compelling Belief, why is it that millions of children who are pushouts or dropouts amount to business as usual in the public schools, while one family educating a child at home becomes a major threat to universal public education and the survival of democracy? Homeschooled students, whether there are 850,000 or 2 million of them, save the tax-paying public billions of dollars a year by withdrawing from the public schools, using $9,000 per pupil as a rough approximation of current annual spending on public schools. Homeschooled students save the tax-paying public between $7 and $18 billion a year, and it has been estimated that homeschooling parents spend about $800 of their own money annually to educate each child. In brief, although no one should be compelled to undertake the unusual dedication required to homeschool their children, those who wish to do so should not have government-placed bureaucratic roadblocks in their way. The evidence to date makes it clear the success rate is much higher for homeschoolers, while the actual cost is lower, as little as zero for taxpayers. The results benefit students, parents, family, and society, and it doesn't get much better than that. Now, that's the article from the Heartland Institute, and they put out a monthly periodical on education. It's well worth subscribing to. It's called the Heartland Institute, 19 South LaSalle Street, number 903, Chicago, Illinois, 60603. And their phone number up there is 312-377-4000. Again, that's 312-377-4000. And if you're online, you can go to www.heartland, that's H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, all one word, .org, heartland.org. Now, why don't we spend some homeschool versus public school solutions? $546 per year, in addition to paying your taxes, will educate one child in your homeschool. Put God back in your child's classroom. Put prayer back in your child's life and classroom. Put morality back in your child's classroom. Put premarital sexual abstinence back in your child's classroom. Teach your child that sex belongs in marriage, not in the back seat of a car. Furnish your child with moral guidance in a home school in place of condoms in public school. Furnish your child a good moral environment in your home school in place of an abortion. teach your children responsibility and responsible behavior in place of sexual relations among adolescents. Teach your own children in your own home school your morals, your values, and stop employing pedophiles and sodomites to teach your children their immorality. Teach the science of the Bible in place of evolutionary fairy tales to your children. Teach the Constitution to your children in place of communism. Teach your child the Bill of Rights instead of socialism. Put the Ten Commandments into your home school. Put the Ten Commandments into your classroom, and throw the ten planks of the Communist Manifesto out. If you don't want to educate a child, don't have one. If you have a child that you don't want to educate, put that child in private school. Follow these 16 steps, and your home school will have none of these problems, such as rape, robbery, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, murder, suicide, absenteeism, vandalism, extortion, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, gang warfare, teen pregnancy, and abortion or VD. You can eliminate those kinds of problems by following these 16 steps in your own home school. What a revelation. What a wild new concept. Huh? And again, you know, put God back into your child's classroom. I mean, after all, that's your classroom right there at your own kitchen table. And if you want to know where to get these programs, you get online and go do some Google search or call the law school, and we'll tell you where to go. Get a Baptist, a Lutheran, a Catholic, or a non-denominational, non-religious school curriculum for homeschool to put your child on a computer. You buy a cheap $100 computer, used, and set him up with these programs, and the child, once he learns how to educate himself, will do just that. He'll educate himself. And he'll follow those paths of interest that interest him. If you want to turn out a genius, homeschool is the place to do it. Hey, I'm about out of time again. So I'm going to have to give you a reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.